I have a true story to tell you before we begin. Absolute 100% true. When I was celebrating my 25th anniversary of ordination, I went to Rome with two other passions. One of them, many of you know, Father Rick Frechette, and another one who you don't know. But so there were the three of us there, and we had a private audience with John Paul II. Now, I had no idea how you go about that. But when you get to the Vatican, there's an arch on the right, and you go in there, and there's all these people waiting in line to see the Pope. And I thought, they're going to put us all together, and we'll go up as a group. But they kept us separate, which was really kind of interesting. And the only thing you had to do is have your name on the list to see the Pope. You didn't have to show an ID or anything. Italian security. What can I tell you? An oxymoron at best. So then we started up, and the Pope is like, I counted, I forget the number of steps now, hundreds and hundreds of steps up. Now, you don't do that all at once. You wander through the Apostolic Palace, going up and through gardens and all this stuff. And it's amazing as you go through, there was a butler there, Jeeves. He was all dressed up in formal mourning clothes, and he would lead you in, and you go from one throne room to the next. I mean, how many throne rooms do you need? But anyway, there were a lot of them. And at one point, we realized that the Pope was in the next room. I don't know how we knew that, but. And the problem was the Cardinal Archbishop of New York and all his bishops were in there before us, so it was a long time. We had to wait, and we're waiting in this throne room to go into the library where the Pope is. And Father Rick said to me, he was getting nervous. He said, "Well, what are you going to say to the Pope?" I said, "What do you mean, what am I going to say to the Pope? I don't make small talk with popes. What am I going to say? How's it going? I mean, really, I'll let him worry about that." So anyway, finally, the Archbishop came out, the Cardinal, and we went in. And in about 2 seconds, you knelt down. Now, I don't know if you ordinarily do that, but at that point, John Paul could not pick his head up. So he had to kneel down to make eye contact. And he gave you a rosary. They took a picture, and that was it. But it was great. I mean, it was a lot of fun. Then the next day, we were invited back for a tour of the Apostolic Palace. And that was great fun. You know, as you go through the Apostolic Palace, the walls were painted by Raphael. Pretty good. So if you need painting done at home, I would recommend him. He's really good. And at one point on the third floor of the palace, there's the in the corner, he had painted these two huge globes, you know, for the world. And it was right in the corner. And I'm looking at the map and I'm saying, there's something wrong here. There was no Australia. They hadn't found it yet. So I went back to our headquarters and I told all the Australian Passionists that Rome did not recognize Australia. And they were very happy about that. So then we come down, you come down all those steps, and we were going to have lunch at St. Martha's. Now, St. Martha's is a hotel that John Paul built for the cardinals so that when they come to vote for a new pope, they have a nice place to stay. Let me tell you, I would ask for a recount constantly. So we went in. Now, if you're looking at St. Peter straight on, the arch on the left, excuse me, is where you go through to get to St. Martha's. Now, they have all the Swiss Guard throughout all of this. And I have to say, it takes a very secure young man to be walking around in those pantaloons in public. So they're all dressed up. And what I never noticed before, I had been to the Vatican before, was they stand on these very shallow wooden boxes, just a little bit off the ground. And so when they stomp their foot, it's like a rifle shot throughout St. Peter's, and everybody turns around. Well, because when St. Paul of the Cross, the founder of the Passionists, went to the Vatican to get the Pope to okay the rule, the Swiss guard thought he was a beggar because he had no shoes and he was dressed in rags, so they threw him out physically. Paybacks are great. So now when a Passionist shows up, and we were in habits, the Swiss guard have to salute. So they stomp, everybody in the square looks around, and then they do this thing with whatever it is, I don't know what you call the swords and all that. And it's really quite impressive. I wanted to keep going back and forth to see, you know, what would happen. So now we're going to go through the arch to St. Martha's, and the Swiss guard are on either side. They stomp, they do all this. Then we have a lovely lunch, and then coming out back through the arch, of course, the Swiss guard are there again, and they're doing the same thing. So now the three of us are walking through the square. But while we were at lunch, the square filled up with thousands of tourists from China. Everybody in China was in St. Peter's Square that day. And this old couple came up to me with a camera and said something in Chinese. And since my Chinese is a little rusty, I said, sure. I thought they wanted me to take their picture. No, no. They wanted a picture of me. Because obviously, you know, with all this, I was a very important person. So then the son and daughter want a picture with me. Pretty soon, every freaking Chinese person in St. Peter's Square wanted a picture with me. And Father Rick is standing there saying, what? Why? I said, well, I think it's obvious. So all over China today, there are people with pictures. I'm probably the most famous unknown person in China saying, ah, very important person. And they don't have a clue. But I'm telling you the story so that you realize how lucky you are to have such an important person give the day of reflection. Not easy. So, but it was great fun. I'd recommend it. Well, I thought it'd be interesting today to start with a prayer from Thomas Merton. It's popularly known as Thomas Merton's Prayer. It's just a little reflection that he wrote. And it got kind of adopted by young people who are trying to figure out what they want to do with their lives. And that's fine, but I think it's a mistake to think because if you're not young, you don't have any questions about what's going to happen, what you should do, or trying to make sense out of the world. So I think it's a real good prayer, period. So, my Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I trust you will always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. And that's from Thoughts in Solitude by Merton. Well, it turns out I arrived in Canada on August 24th, 2002, and I expected a big reception, only to find out the Pope came 2 weeks before and stole all my thunder. So then I decide I'm going to do a talk on loneliness at Christmas, and the Star steals my thunder. They published two articles on loneliness. One of them, it's not really so much an article, it's just reporting. It says 37% of Torontonians report feeling lonely at least 3 or 4 days in the last week, making Torontonians, the loneliest Canadians. Loneliness among high school students has doubled, with 44% feeling frequently lonely. And mental health is just as dire now as it was earlier in the pandemic. One in four adult Torontonians report symptoms of a major depressive disorder. Almost one in five reports symptoms of moderate anxiety. The percentage of people with six or more close friends declined by nearly 30 percentage points from 2013 to 2022. So as the Toronto Star points out, loneliness is an epidemic. Now, if you were to read this article, it's really quite depressing. You find out, on top of the fact now that you're lonely and depressed, that it's killing you. And so you better not be lonely or depressed. Well, you know, what can you do? And I think it's very misleading. I mean, they can prove that there's a connection between loneliness and heart disease and all of that. And that's true, but I don't think it happens that quickly. And it also depends, I think, on what you do with your loneliness. It can be very unhealthy, or it can be really healthy, because there's no escaping loneliness, not just at Christmas, but anytime. It's a basic human experience, and therefore it has a good side. We frequently are in touch with the not so good side, the side that hurts, and the side that we just want to escape. But there's real purpose in being lonely sometimes. Now, here's an article. God may have put you in a lonely place for an incredible reason. And this is from Fox News. So, and it goes on to give some of the ways in which you can use loneliness to your advantage. But when I first got the idea of doing this talk years ago, I thought of Thomas Merton, because he was, throughout his life, a profoundly lonely person. And at the end of his life, we see him moving into a hermitage. Not the usual thing for somebody who is lonely. So there's a whole lot that happened in his life. And I think this time of year in particular, what's really damaging is our fantasy of what Christmas should be. Everybody but us is having a Hallmark Christmas, where their loved ones have flown in from all over, and everything is wonderful, and the food is great, and most families are a mess at Christmas and throughout the year. And all those tensions get greater, and it can become a very lonely thing. In fact, we talk about holiday blues. Just the fact that Christmas is coming, people feel isolated and lonely and helpless. And hopefully today we'll find out that we really are not helpless. And of course, loneliness is heightened, especially at this time of year, if we've recently lost a loved one, and this is the first Christmas without the loved one. It could be the loss of a friendship, a family that's disintegrating. It can even happen to us as we advance in years. Suddenly we find everybody we know is gone, and we're left behind. And that can be profoundly lonely. And of course, then there's the Christmas songs and carols that tell us that we should have ourselves a merry little Christmas. Great. Well, I don't know about you, but I mean, that's a perfectly good song. I like the song. That's fine. But again, I think it's very misleading. We're looking for happiness at Christmas, and I think we're selling ourselves really short. I don't want happiness. I want full-bodied joy. Joy to the world is what we should be looking for at Christmas, not happiness. Happiness is something that happens to us. That's where the root comes from, happenstance. And in every Indo-European language, the root is the same. It's like in our DNA, we equate happiness with what happens to us. But joy is not something that happens to us. It comes from who we are and being able to connect with others and with God. And that's really what Christmas is about, not about being happy. There's a prayer that keeps coming up at Mass. It's the closing prayer, sometimes on a weekday, sometimes on Sunday, that say, Lord, you know, give us eternal happiness. No, I want more than that, eternal happiness. And sometimes they say gladness, which is even worse, you know, joy. So the words that are important at this time of year, I think, are joy, hope, that's a really important word, and compassion. Those are things that will transform and help us get in touch with our own selves. Now, part of the problem with using Thomas Merton as an example of that is Thomas Merton is an intellectual. He's not a scholar. And what that means is when he writes, he has a thesis and then an antithesis and then a synthesis, and then he'll come back to it in 6 months and he'll do it all over. So it's very hard to pin him down on what he really thinks about any specific thing. So you have to do a lot of research and a lot of reading. But what he eventually does is really amazing if he can follow it through. So just today, I'm going to just briefly go through his life story so you appreciate where he came from and how he ended up in a hermitage and what that means. Now, in his early life, both his parents were artists. His mother was a dancer. His father was a watercolor artist, a very successful one at that. He had shows all over the world. So he has that artistic sense in his life. He approaches everything through the eyes of an artist. But their biggest influence in his life, his parents, were his absence. His mother was kind of typically the cold mother, who kept him at arm's length. And the father was just absent all the time. He was always someplace else in the world. And his mother died when he was only 6 years old. And because he was six, he couldn't go into the hospital to see her before she died. So the mother gave a letter, big long letter, to the father to give Thomas, who was sitting under a tree in the yard in the hospital. And the father gave him the letter and walked away. And this six-year-old kid had to figure out what death meant. And he said he couldn't quite get it. He said he knew he would never see his mother again. But that's all he could make out. And he went into a deep adult grief. He had nothing, no one to share it with. He did have a brother. He didn't get along with his brother. So that was not a good relationship. His father died when he was 16, and he was informed by a telegram. And it wasn't stating necessarily right off the bat that his father was dying, and in fact had died. It was supposedly a telegram from the father telling him he was sailing into New York, and that was impossible. And so Merton knew at that point that his father had died. And again, he was alone in an apartment, 16 years old, with no one to help take that information in. So from very early on, he really is alone in the world. He's an orphan. And neither parent gave him any religious training. Now, he was baptized. He came from Prades, France, which is in the Pyrenees, the south of France. And he was baptized, but that was it. They didn't do anything with him. And as a young boy, he kept being moved because of the father. The mother died when he was six, but the father kept going. So he lived in Bermuda, France, the U.S., England, and he made a game out of moving so much, and he called it prisoner's base. That's what he thought about, because he could make friends, but he could never keep them. So they were always on the move. And finally, Merton felt at home with his godfather. Now, his godfather lived in England, and he was a wealthy man, and he was kind of taking over once Merton's father died. But he was an urbane man of the world, so teenage Thomas Merton decided to copy him. And supposedly he got a young woman pregnant. And when the godfather found out about it, he blew up and threw him out. And Merton just thought that's what you do. Now, there, I don't know if in fact he did father a child or not. If he did not, it was not for lack of trying. I mean, he actually bragged that he learned Hungarian in bed. I don't know how fluent he was, but there's no evidence, there's no legal evidence that he actually fathered a child. And it's too neat a story. Here's this young man who's going to become a Trappist and a famous writer, gets a young woman pregnant, excuse me, and both child and mother are killed in the Blitzkrieg on London. Excuse me, so end of problem. It just seems a little too neat and Hollywood to me, but the point being, he was sexually active, and he was partly doing that, trying to overcome the loneliness. And of course, it didn't actually really work for him. Then he went to Rome, and for the first time, he saw religious art. And again, remember, he's seen everything through the eyes of an artist. And it never dawned on him that art could be spiritual. It was always kind of semi-pornographic for him. And so that really was the beginning of his conversion. Intellectually, he was converted later on in life when he was living in New York. He read a book called The History of Medieval Philosophy by the philosopher Gilson. Now, the idea in that book that he found so fascinating was aseity, A-S-E-I-T-Y. And basically, what it means is God is being. And you get all excited by this. Well, let me tell you, if you ever have trouble sleeping, buy a copy of that book, start reading about aseity. It'll put you to sleep faster than a homily on a Sunday. I mean, it's a teleological argument. Only a philosopher could get excited about that. Now, Father Dennis is a philosopher, so maybe he'll get excited about it, but I'm just going to move on because it's just not worth it. So he's dealing with loneliness because loneliness is how he identifies himself. And he does it by making a game out of it. He tries losing it through sexual activity. Then he began to drink heavily, as a lot of college students will do. And he spent a whole summer pretty much drunk while he was writing the great American novel with some friends of his, and they lived in a cabin in the woods. And when it was his turn to cook, he fried hamburgers in scotch. So that didn't work too well either. Then he became a member of the Communist Party, trying to belong again. But it wasn't, again, a lot of college students at that time just became members of the Communist Party. He went by the name of Frank Swift. But anyway, he continues on with the history of medieval philosophy, and he got all excited about that. And then he became baptized a Catholic on November 16th, 1938. The reason why that's interesting is because he already was baptized. But at that time, before Vatican II, you baptize somebody Catholic. Not Christian, but Catholic, you know. Now we say if it's a valid baptism, that's it. You don't do it a second time. But at that time they did. So he was at Columbia, studying at Columbia, when he was finally baptized a Catholic. And while he was at Columbia, he became interested in the Catholic religion. And being a good convert, excuse me, he wanted to be the most Catholic he could be, so he decided he would be a priest. And he decided he would become a Franciscan, and he went to teach at St. Bonaventure's in Olean, New York, which was run by the Franciscans. And he applied to them, and they accepted him, but then he got guilt feelings, so he went to confession and fessed up to everything he had done, and the priest tore into him and kicked him out and told him, you don't have a vocation, go away, never come back, and all that stuff. Once again, he was absolutely crushed. So he decided, well, if he couldn't be a priest, then he's going to live like one. So he bought a prayer book, and he'd said all the prayers every day. And he finally went on a retreat to Gethsemane in Kentucky, run by the Trappists. And again, a Hollywood moment. As soon as he steps onto the grounds of the Abbey of Gethsemane, the bells go off, the sun comes out, the birds chirp, and everything is perfect. He's absolutely sure that this is the most perfect place in the whole world. Now, after he lives there for 27 years, that changes a little bit, but he found a place to call home. And the interesting thing about being at home there was that gave him stability. He was no longer on the run everywhere. And he was a writer. He had a great talent for writing. And so the abbot, who was a former passionist from Baltimore, had him write all these really bad books about saints. You know, they were terrible books. I read them. He's right. They are terrible. But they saw a real promise in him. But because of that, he had this tremendous pull in his life. He didn't want to be a writer because he wanted to escape the world and disappear. But he was a writer. So what do? You know, you can't deny who you are. So he struggled with that. Eventually, he had a nervous breakdown right around the time he was ordained. And it was really a terrible suffering for him. But for the first time, he couldn't run anywhere. And he got stuck in his loneliness and his pain. And he just had to get through it. Now, he doesn't tell us a whole lot about what happened there. But he eventually comes out of it. He had writer's block, too, at that point, which was a real suffering for him. But he finally got better. And then he quickly became appointed director of students and then novice master, which, if you know anything about monasticism, aside from the abbot, those are the two most important positions. So they recognized something special in him, even though he had just come out of a bad depression. And then here's this man who spent his whole life running from being lonely. One day he was walking downtown Louisville, and he had a conversion experience on the corner of 4th and Walnut, which was right downtown. Excuse me, he wrote in 1958, in Louisville at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I love all those people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious isolation, in a special world, the world of renunciation and supposed holiness. This sense of liberation from an illusory difference was such a relief and a joy to me. So for the first time, he no longer sees as running to the monastery as leaving the world behind. He now begins to see it as a way to be in the very center of the world. Now, I've been to Louisville, and I decided I would take a picture of 4th and Walnut. Nice. No. First of all, it doesn't exist anymore. They moved it, and they renamed it 4th and Muhammad Ali Boulevard, which doesn't have the same ring. So, but anyway, it's still there. And there's actually one of those historic markers that you see a lot of times on the side of the road. It is the only historic marker, at least in the United States, that's dedicated to a mystical experience. So it was a really important thing in his life. So now he's beginning to reflect on solitude and wanting more and more solitude. And he eventually wants to become a hermit. Now, when he was a hermit, it didn't happen right away. He was allowed to be in a hut for a few hours a day to write. And then eventually they built him a hermitage and he could live there full time. But when he was living there full time, the abbot, the former Passionist, was not very nice. He had him psychoanalyzed by a famous psychologist at that time whom he had never met. And so the man psychoanalyzed him from his writings, which is absolutely not ethical to do that. And he tore into Mert and he said, "You want to be a hermit in Times Square." Well, he was right. Merton did want to be a hermit in Times Square, but it was not very kind. And he certainly didn't couch it at all. And in fact, many people did visit him at the hermitage. Some famous people like Joan Baez. And even though he was in the woods, everybody knew where he was. And he kind of liked being the center of attention. So he did want to be a hermit in Times Square. But he also entered into real solitude at that point. And then his writings, his social writings, become really great. His brother finally comes to reconcile with him, and his brother is going off to war. So there's a beautiful scene in Seven Story Mountain where Merton is down in the nave of the church and the brother is up in the choir loft. And at that time, Trappists did not speak ever. They used sign language. So Thomas Merton looks up and there is his brother, John Paul, and he can't say hello. He has to sign, and of course, doesn't mean anything to the brother. But eventually they get together, and John Paul wants to become Catholic, so in one night, they cram all of RCIA into one night and baptize him the next morning in the local Catholic church. And a few months later, he joined the Canadian Air Force, went into World War II, was shot down over the English Channel, lived for like 5 days floating on debris, and died. And one of Merton's best poems was to his brother, saying all the things that he couldn't say in life. But anyway, so now he's really alone. His brother is gone. All the other relatives he had in the world, the cousins and stuff, they're all gone. And there he is alone, and he's in physical solitude. And so now his writings begin to take on a whole different flavor. All his social justice writings, there and there. He got in trouble for a lot of that. He was censured by the Trappists and by the church because he was saying things like the Vietnam War was not a good idea, you know, really radical things like that. But he paid for it. But he was smart. So he was told he couldn't publish. So he privately published. He used a mimeograph machine, gave copies to his friends, who then copied them, and it went on. And we have all those works. So he found a way around it. So he was very clever, to be sure. So his loneliness starts to show up in his writings. Excuse me. And basically, in Merton's writing, if he can follow it through long enough, you realize he's talking about two different kinds of loneliness, and that's the key. There's the loneliness of no matter how close you are to another person, a couple that's been married for 70 years, a successful marriage, whatever, there always remain two separate people. They can become one, but they are still separate. And there's nothing you can do about that. That's just a given in life. We can never cross that barrier. Then, so that's existential loneliness. And then there's anxiety loneliness, which is what most of us mean when we talk about loneliness. When we're feeling lonely and upset, we're talking about anxiety, loneliness, and that's the problem because we get anxious and it's uncomfortable and we don't want to sit with it. We don't want to run. We want to run from it. But there was a famous jazz singer, Billie Holiday, and she has a wonderful song. She suffered terribly from depression and addiction. And she wrote a song, Good Morning Heartache, Sit Down. She finally had heartache, the loneliness, sit down, and she talked to it. And she accepted it and began to change it. And that's really what we have to do with our anxiety, loneliness, acknowledge it, and then accept it and see what we can do with it. So, by the way, when I read quotes from Merton, I apologize in advance because he used sexist language. It was everybody did at that time. It was just starting to come into vogue that it really was sexist. So he always talks about man and him and all that. He really meant everybody, but that was the way that they talked. It sounds really harsh today when we hear it. So anyway, he became interested in the Eastern religions. He was always interested in them, especially Buddhism and Zen and Hinduism to a point. And so he went to give a talk in Bangkok, Thailand, to a group of Catholic religious leaders. And he gave a talk. It was not a very good talk. It was not his best. And it was filmed by a Dutch film TV crew. And for some reason, they started out, there's Merton, and they walk around behind him and fix the camera on his bald head for the rest of the talk. So it wasn't a great hit. But anyway, he gave the talk, and then he sat down. And then he went back up. Everybody says his last words were, and now I'll disappear. That was the last words of the talk that he gave. But he went back to the microphone and he said, so let's everybody go have a Coke. Those were his last public words. The great mystic, let's go have a Coke. And he went to his room, took a shower, and going into the shower or coming out of the shower, there was a fan, this floor standing fan, and it wasn't grounded. And he touched it, and he was electrocuted. And the fan fell over on top of him and burned him. And to me, there's been all kinds of stories about his death. The conspiracy theories, the FBI, the CIA were after him. They weren't. They had a file on him because of his writings about war, but they weren't after him. And everybody made such a big deal out of the fact that he had his shorts on. Well, if he was taking a shower, why did he have his shorts on? Well, it turns out at that time, Archbishop Weakland was the head of the Benedictines. So he was there, and he heard Merton cry out and fall. So he went into the room, and there was Merton on the floor, dead, naked. And everybody's word spread real fast, so everybody was coming into the room. So there was a nun there who was a medical doctor, and the two of them put his shorts back on. So no great mystery. But, I mean, people went wild with that. It couldn't be. Why would that be? It was just out of respect for Thomas Merton. And so he died there, and he's the only Trappist who is buried in a coffin because they had to fly him back from Bangkok on a plane, an American military plane, with all the dead from Vietnam. And so they needed to have a coffin for him. So he's the only one in Kentucky or anywhere that's buried in a coffin. And so, once again, I mean, he met death completely alone. And he just struggled with that his whole life. He had a very difficult relationship with his abbot. I think it would be very difficult to have been his abbot because he was really smart and quick. And I think he could be very cutting, and he didn't suffer fools. So he died there, and then he's buried in Kentucky. And so we'll take a little break, and then we'll get into the difference between loneliness and solitude in his writings. And that's where we can see how we can begin to shape our loneliness, not just be a victim of it, but begin to take it in hand and invite it to sit down and to talk with it. Okay. Oh, and we have a microphone. If anybody has questions, I just, you know, use the microphone so everybody can hear the questions. If nobody has questions, that's okay too. The mic will still work. So, but anyway, so there are some refreshments. I'm not sure exactly. I know there are cookies and coffee, and I'm not sure what else out there. So maybe if we take like a 15-minute break and then come back and we'll see what Merton himself has to say about loneliness. Another true story for you. This one a little closer to home in New York. When I was living in the Bronx, New York, a passionist friend of mine was living in Brooklyn. And so once a month, we would get together in Manhattan and do something and have dinner. And so we did all kinds of interesting things. But at that time, the planetarium at the Museum of Natural History had been closed for about 3 or 4 years. They were renovating it. So finally it was open and it got great reviews. You're saying, you know, the planetarium, but really this is like a planetarium on steroids. It was great. So finally we got it open. So we met at the museum and bought tickets, but because it was so popular, we had like an hour and a half to wait before we could get in. And so I said to my friend from Brooklyn, I said, well, why don't we go around and look at the exhibits around the planetarium? And it was all on geological things. And I know nothing about geology. Rocks, I mean, there's not a lot you can say. So they had all these exhibits with cards telling you what you were looking at and why it's important. And of course, I'm trying to read all these things, and my friend keeps talking about everything in the world but rocks and asking all these stupid questions. And so I'm starting to get annoyed, and then suddenly he got really quiet. And he turned to me and he said, why do we have oil? I said, what do you mean, why do we have oil? What kind of question is that? He said, well, where does oil come from? I said, well, I think it comes from a bunch of little critters that died and went bad. You know, I didn't want to be too technical. And he said, well, what happens to oil if you don't use it? I said, I don't know. I guess if you leave it in the ground long enough over millions of years and it turns into coal, I don't know. And he said, well, what happens if you don't use coal? And I said, well, I think millions of years and billions of degrees of heat and pressure, coal turns into diamonds. And he said, well, what happens? I said, diamonds turn into jewelry, jewelry turns into sex, and that's why we have oil. I mean, what do I look like? The answer man? The sad part is he's a bishop today. And I tell you, tells you all you need to know. So anyway, and he's back in New York, so that's good for him. Okay, well, now we're going to take a look at Merton's writings about loneliness and solitude. And for Merton, the way out of loneliness was solitude. Once he was able to catch on to the idea of solitude, then he was, I wouldn't say he was no longer lonely, but he knew how to deal with it and what to do with it. And so it was a whole different perspective for him on being alone. He was still alone, but it was entirely different. So then suddenly he begins to write things which you would never expect him to write, such as, in fleeing loneliness, he, man, sorry, flees himself and God. And if we take away another's loneliness, we take away his vocation. Now, there's a really different way of thinking about loneliness, that we all are called to the vocation of loneliness. Now, I want to point out, if you're in crisis because you've just lost a loved one or something, that's an entirely different thing. You know, I'm not saying you should just sit there and wallow in it. You do whatever it is you need to do to get out of the crisis, however long that takes. But what I'm talking about is when you're not in crisis and the loneliness just kind of settles in and sits down and it's uncomfortable and you don't know what to do. That's a whole different thing. So that's what we're talking about here. When we talk about taking away a person's loneliness is taking away their vocation. So it's a really different way of thinking about it. And then he also went on to basically discover two different kinds of loneliness, which I mentioned before. One is the existential loneliness. That's the physical separation of people. There's nothing you can do. You can minimize that, but you can never breach it. Even in the Trinity, you have three distinct divine persons in one God. Now, that's another whole problem, but even with God, there's an existential loneliness built in. And then there's the anxiety loneliness, and that's what can become solitude. And Merton wrote, "Working in the woods in the afternoon, I felt lonely and small and humiliated. Yet it gives me a kind of satisfaction to realize that it is not by contact with any other creature, that existential loneliness, that I can recover the sense that I am real. Solitude means being lonely, not in a way that pleases you, but in a way that frightens you." That's the anxiety. "And empties you to the extent that it means being exiled even from yourself." Now, that's a whole lot to say in one sentence there. But again, he emphasizes the point when he says, he wrote again, "After my ordination," now remember he had a nervous breakdown right around that time, "I discovered that the essence of a solitary vocation is that it is a vocation to fear, to helplessness, to isolation in the invisible God." That's anxiety loneliness. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun, and it's not. But again, so solitude for Merton, if he wrote it in an equation, would be the anxiety loneliness plus God. You invite God into your loneliness, and that changes everything. So it's only in moments of loneliness that we discover the spark within ourselves, the divine spark, that little light. Because when we're not lonely, we're too busy and distracted running around, we lose sight of that. That's what it means to have a vocation to loneliness, to realize that and to sit with that. So solitude then becomes the ability and willingness to stand alone before God exactly as we are. We don't have to change anything. And when we do this, we discover, and Merton wrote, and again, I apologize, "man's loneliness is in fact the loneliness of God. That is why it is such a great thing for man to discover his solitude and to learn to live in it. For there he finds that he and God are one, that God is alone, as he himself is alone, that God wills to be alone in man." So again, God himself is existentially lonely. There's that separation, but then there's that other loneliness, that anxiety loneliness, and that's where God invites us in, and we invite God in, and that's where the change can take place. It may still feel the same, but it changes what happens. In other words, the way for us to draw closer to God, to minimize the aloneness, the existential loneliness, is to live our solitude, just to be content with it. God's solitude is seen as his being. Now, Merton merges that idea with the concept that God is love. So love and solitude become the same thing for Merton. And if you remember, I told you about the idea of aseity from the Jill song that's really boring. Well, Merton still was taken with that idea, and he changes it a little bit. He gives it a little more texture and depth to it. And basically, what Merton is saying is that that anxiety loneliness becomes the school of compassion. Now, I always thought of compassion as something that you learn from other people or by doing. What Merton is saying is compassion comes from within, and you bring it out, you activate it. But the only way you can really come into contact with that compassion is to be willing to sit in that aloneness. And that's really what takes over. Now, he uses a really rich symbol to describe precisely what kind of love solitude is. And that's the symbol of the desert. The desert fathers were the first hermits. They were alone in the desert. Now, I really, really don't like deserts, and I've been in a lot of them for some reason. But there are no distractions in the desert. You know, you don't have to worry about checking your phone or anything. There's no distraction. You have to come face to face with yourself and with God in the desert. There's just no alternative. So he wrote, "There is no wilderness so terrible, so beautiful, and so arid, and so fruitful as the wilderness of compassion. It is the only desert that shall truly flourish like the lily." So while a desert looks barren, there is life in the desert. And that's what compassion is. It's that life that has to grow and flourish. Now, describing the desert even further, he states that more than we fear, we love the holy desert, where separate strangers, hid in their disguises, have come by night to meet the quiet Christ. So the holy desert, where separate strangers, the loneliness, come by night to meet the quiet Christ. That transforms loneliness into solitude. Now, of course, compassion becomes central to all of his social writings, but compassion is not born in good deeds done for others. It is born in the desert. So for Merton, his monastery was not a home, but rather a desert, which is a place where I disappear from the world in order to be everywhere in it by hiddenness and compassion. In fact, if a person is able to learn compassion in his solitude, that compassion must be expressed in a concrete manner. So compassion is not a feeling to get you feeling good or less lonely. The whole point of compassion is to change and to bring it outside, to actualize it, and to activate it. So when a person is able to learn compassion in solitude, that compassion no longer, we no longer own our solitude. Now it's going out of us to meet the solitudes of the other. And Merton felt that when he was alone, they are not they, but his own self. And for a solitary, that is a lonely person who chooses to love in the face of fear. And in the face of fear, there are no strangers. Remember that experience at 4th and Walnut. He was completely alone. He saw all these strangers, and there was that instant in which he was able to see that spark, and he was one with them. That didn't come by something that he did. It was something that he realized within himself. So if, as Merton claims, compassion is the true fruit and purpose of solitude, it's important that to note that our capacity for solitude is directly dependent upon God's compassion for us. We have received compassion. That's that little light inside. We can't generate that. We can encounter it. We can nurture it. But it's a gift that's given to each of us. Merton points in that direction when he states, "Only solitude has taught me that I do not have to be a god or an angel to be pleasing to God, that I do not have to become a pure intelligence without feeling and without human imperfection before God will listen to my voice. And when this is learned," he said, "then our love of others becomes pure and strong. We can go out to them without vanity, without complacency, loving them with something of the purity and gentleness and hiddenness of God's love for us." Now, if that's all happening in your loneliness is really different from when you first felt uncomfortable. It's a whole different way of being in the world. Christmas and loneliness. You know, again, this is the time of year that's really tricky for a lot of people. And again, if you're in crisis, by all means, do whatever you need to do. But if you're not, just pay attention. Pay attention to what that's all about. God's love for us and acceptance of us is what Christmas is all about. It's not about the Hallmark movie or any of that stuff. I mean, I'm not against Hallmark movies or some of the Christmas carols I really love, but that's not what it's about. It's really not about all that. So when we're missing that, we're not missing Christmas. You know, we're missing a fantasy in our head. And we can do something about that. So Merton's life and writing show us that only in loneliness and solitude can we uncover the full truth and joy of Christmas. Again, joy and hope are what Christmas is about, not about happiness or merry. Nothing against happiness, nothing against merry, but we're selling ourselves way short. Christmas is a whole lot more than that. It's more than a nice meal with a family or with friends. Perfectly good things to do, but it's a whole lot more than that. Now, this reading from Isaiah you'll hear today at Mass and tomorrow. It's from the second Sunday of Advent. "Then the wolf shall be a guest of the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid. The calf and the young lion shall browse together, with a little child to guide them. The cow and the bear shall be neighbors. Together their young shall rest. The lion shall eat hay like the ox. The baby shall play by the cobra's den, and the child lay his hand on the adder's lair. There shall be no harm or ruin on all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as water covers the sea. On that day, the root of Jesse set up as a signal for the nations, the Gentiles shall seek out, for his dwelling shall be glorious." That's Christmas. It's wild. It doesn't make sense. It breaks all the rules. That's what incarnation did and does. It's wild. And it's great. The wolf is the guest of the lamb. I mean, really? We killed wild beasts because we're afraid of them. But maybe it's better to pay attention now if you're encountering an actual wild beast. Good idea. But I mean, when you're encountering them inside, don't kill them off so quickly. Pay attention to what they're doing. And I mean, our world is materialistic, so we want a nice higher standard of living, and everything is nice and smooth, and I like all that. But it is the work of unbridled compassion, born of solitude, to make peace of our own personal fears. The wild beasts and innocent lambs of our personalities become tamed in the terrible, lonely expanses of our hearts. But only if we open that up to that. And until this happens, Christ cannot be born in our lives, and Christmas is a busy, empty noise celebrating nothing. It's distracting us from our solitude, from our loneliness. But if our solitude is attended to by the ears of compassion, we can begin to hear in the far distant night the lonely, fleeting cry of a newborn babe, which gives voice to the anguish of untold centuries. Torn from time, it whimpers softly, reverberating through the wilderness, taking root in the barren desert of a solitary lover. So Merton wrote, "Heed well. When I, loneliness, give my special signal, follow my silence, follow where I beckon. Fear not, little beast, little spirit, thou word and animal. I, solitude, am angel, and I have prayed in your name." And that's taken from Song, If You Seek. It's one of the collected poems of Thomas Merton. Here's a man who ran from being lonely his whole life, saying, "Follow my silence. Follow where I beckon. I, solitude, am angel, and I have prayed in your name." So any comments, questions, experiences of your own? See, the thing about loneliness is it's a universal experience. I always thought I was very lucky as a young person. I knew I wanted to be a Passionist and a priest, and I expected to be lonely. But I think most young people getting married think, oh, this is great. I'm never going to be lonely again. And I mean, there are, as you know, an enormous amount of marriages that are exceptionally lonely. It's part of the work of marriage. But it's not what we expect. So. Yes, Paul, wait a minute. They do. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, he has to say something. Right. Yes. That's right. I don't know if you could hear that, but he was saying. Well, that's right. Yeah. Oh, yes. Mhm. Mhm. Right. Mhm. Right. Yeah. Now, Paul was saying that Trappists take a vow of silence. They don't speak. They do now, but at the time of Merton, they did not. I mean, you never talked. You had that sign language special to them. It wasn't sign language that, you know, deaf people use. But yeah, you never spoke, but he found a way. He found his voice in writing. So he got around that, and he virtually wrote everything he ever thought. He's one of those people. He left no thought unpublished and sold. But yes, so that was part of it. But the second part was the retreat to solitude, right, yeah. Right. Yeah, he went into the hermitage, yeah. Right. It was not very far away, though. It was very close. It's interesting. You go there, and it feels like it's miles away, and it's really quite close. It's on a little hill that's surrounded by trees, and you would easily miss it. But yeah, he lived there, and he did a lot of his writing there. But again, that's how he found his voice. But first, he had to take care of that conflict between being a writer and a monk who's not supposed to speak. But finally, he found a way of making peace with that and doing both. And thank God he did, you know. So, again. Okay. Well. I can't silence the mic. Damn it. Oh. Oh, well. Carefully. Okay, so this Christmas, make friends with the aloneness. You know, you can really discover a whole lot about yourself. It's that idea, that little light. That's why we light candles at Christmas, you know, to remind us of that. And the reason why candles were first used in homes was to bring the starlight into the house. It wasn't sunlight, but it was starlight. And that's why they ended up on Christmas trees and all that. But it still works. I mean, it's still that important symbol, even if it doesn't spread a whole lot of actual light, you know. But it's getting in contact with that inner light and allowing that to illumine our fears and know that God is in there with us. So we can be fearless. And that's what we're called to do. It's not a mistake. It's not something's wrong. It's the way it is. So, and if you don't want loneliness or silence this Christmas, come to the children's mass. It's a hoot, I'll tell you. It's better than the first one. So, okay. Well, it's 3:35. It's a little early, but the 4:30 mass, they'll start coming in a little before 4. So thank you for coming out on a gray day. I hope you have a joy-filled Christmas throughout the year. So, thank you. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Yep. Very good.